currently hearing Paul Kalkbrenner with the tune Cody 3000 from The Essence. Before this, we had Anzola and the tune Cinco Bets from Bodega. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. That's about it for me for this show. If you missed a show or you want to get in touch with me, my website is at djfirefly.com.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, for the entire program, we're joined by former legal counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lisa Graves, to discuss her explosive new book, Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights.
She breaks down how over the last 20 years, Roberts has turned the Supreme Court into the legal arm of the conservative wing of the Republican Party. They're reshaping constitutional law and chipping away at hard-won civil rights and civil liberties. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. Early in his second term, after addressing a joint session of Congress, as he shook hands walking down the aisle, President Donald Trump turned to Chief Justice John Roberts, patted him on the back, and said, thank you again, I won't forget. What had Roberts done to deserve such gratitude? A lot. In her withering and revealing new book, Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights, Lisa Graves describes in detail how Roberts, quote, has established himself not as a fair referee, but as a diabolically effective player, rewriting the Constitution and remaking America in accord with his reactionary political agenda, as he strategizes how to move the ball forward and disarm the opposition, unquote. Sound too hyperbolic? Read the book. We're very pleased to have Lisa Graves with us again on Law and Disorder. She knows what she's talking about. After serving as Deputy Assistant Attorney General under Attorneys General Janet Reno, a Democrat, and John Ashcroft, a Republican, she was Chief Counsel for Nominations for Senator Patrick Leahy on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, where she investigated the careers and ideologies of judicial nominees, including John Roberts. She also learned how to examine the finances of sitting judges as Deputy Chief of the Article III Judges Division of the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts with oversight of the Financial Disclosure Office. She was an adjunct law professor at George Washington University Law School and worked as a senior legislative strategist for the ACLU on national security and civil liberties. From 2009 to 2017, she led the Center for Media and Democracy. More recently, she co-founded Court Accountability and is also the current executive director of True North Research, a national investigative watchdog group that describes its mission as exposing, quote, the dark money fueling regressive agendas targeting vital institutions in our republic, such as our courts and public schools, unquote. Lisa, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Stephen, so much. It's a real joy to be back on the show with you, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, most people first heard of John Roberts during his Senate confirmation hearing on September 12, 2005, when he famously disarmed critics by assuring everyone that, quote, I have no agenda, but I do have a commitment. If I am confirmed, I will confront every case with an open mind, and I will remember that it's my job to call balls and strikes and not to pitch or bat. He also swore under oath that, quote, no one is above the law under our system, and that includes the president, who, quote, is fully bound by the law, the Constitution, and statutes. Lisa, you write, quote, I strongly suspected that assertion was not true then, and it is demonstrably untrue now. Why are you convinced that John Roberts lied to the Senate and the American people?
I think that John Roberts has done tremendous damage to the United States Constitution and to our republic, to our democracy, through a series of decisions that the Roberts Court has issued that have made it harder for Americans to vote, harder to have our voices heard, harder to have fair representation in our representative form of government. And has also, the court has also put its thumb on the scale of justice in favor of some of the most powerful interests in the country, at odds with the interests of most American people. One of the things I discovered in writing this book was that John Roberts had created that analogy for George W. Bush in order to get his support for the nomination, because George Bush had been an owner of a Major League Baseball team. And so George Bush actually writes about this memory he had of meeting Roberts and this notion that he was just going to be an umpire and not a player on the field. And of course, Roberts reprised this claim for the American people when he was nominated during his hearings. But what I discovered was that John Roberts actually didn't play baseball in high school. He was a football player. And in fact, based on some of the other books that had come out a while back, we learned that John Roberts had actually been known as a really mean tackler. And in fact, his coach gave an interview to a dark money group that helped back his confirmation Supreme Court. And his coach said that Roberts was a particularly feisty linebacker who was devoted to studying how to tackle and beat his opponents. And that's who I think we really have on the Supreme Court. But that small story is just a window into how John Roberts tried to contrive this image of himself as a fair umpire, when in fact he was chosen because he was believed to be a sure vote for advancing a very regressive agenda on the court of reversing a number of precedents in American law. And in fact, that hearing, that quote you reprised yourself there, Stephen, about how John Roberts pledged to the American people, promised to the American people that no one is above the law, he broke that promise when it mattered the most, when Donald Trump asserted unprecedented immunity from criminal prosecution. John Roberts orchestrated a ruling giving him retroactive immunity and paving his way back into power.
Lisa, in your new book, you delve into the most important Supreme Court decisions of the last 20 years, and you argue that Roberts conveniently casts aside long-established legal precedents to reach his pre-existing conclusions. And he selectively uses the theory of originalism, limiting the Constitution to its meaning in the 18th century, when it suits his purpose, while ignoring it when it doesn't. Can you give us some examples of how he has distorted the Constitution in this way?
I definitely think, Heidi, that the immunity decision, it should be Exhibit A in what John Roberts has done, because when you look at the language of our Constitution, there is no immunity from criminal prosecution in Article 2 of the Constitution. There actually is immunity for members of Congress for the speech and debate clause, for the statements they make on the floor. So the founders and the framers knew how to write immunity into the Constitution when they wanted to, but they did not do so for a president. And in fact, the Constitution makes clear that a president can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, which also indicates that a president can be guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. And more than that, This notion that no one is above the law is a vital pillar of our democracy. It is one of the core reasons articulated in the Declaration of Independence for the Revolutionary War, for our separation from England, because in the very first clause of the complaints, the men who signed that declaration said that the king was not following the laws, In this instance, you have a constitution, our constitution, that expressly commands that the president has a duty to faithfully execute the law. It says so twice in the constitution. And nothing can be less faithful than breaking the law, and breaking the criminal law in particular. Even the senator from Kentucky who helped pave the way for the court capture, Senator Mitch McConnell, during the impeachment trial of Donald Trump around the second impeachment after January 6th, he noted that, of course, a president can be tried criminally, and he and some Republicans suggested that that was the proper course of action for Donald Trump's activities around January 6th, his efforts to subvert that election. And so that really is Exhibit A, but it's not the only exhibit. There are numerous other instances in which John Roberts has used the judicial power to intervene in ways that disregard longstanding precedents, disregard our constitutional provisions. That includes the Voting Rights Act, which I think we'll talk about more later. But another case where this really becomes clear to me is in the Citizens United decision, where there's a long set of cases that expressly understand that Congress has the power to protect against corruption. Congress has the power to write rules around our elections. And in fact, even though there had been an early decision in the 1970s, the Buckley versus Vallejo case, that allowed candidates to self-finance their campaigns without going outside of the limits of the Federal Election Campaign Act, the Supreme Court had upheld a number of other provisions that allowed Congress to regulate elections. But in 2010, the Roberts Court issued a decision that dramatically changed the interpretation of our First Amendment. And in striking down McCain-Feingold, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, and related provisions and precedents, the Roberts Court, in essence, cleared the field and said that Congress could not regulate this outside spending in elections, and asserted that our First Amendment compelled that result such that Congress would have no power to pass a law like the McCain-Feingold Act that set, you know, rules for when someone is spending a lot of money on advertising right before an election, and that set rules about coordination, about identification of donors, that those groups would have to disclose their donors. This was a new interpretation of the First Amendment that this court, the Roberts Court, took on, and it did so in a way that now has paved the way for 15 years of extraordinary spending by billionaires in America, because this notion that money is speech and therefore it cannot be regulated if it is not given directly to a candidate has dramatically altered the course of political history, so much so that based on that ruling in this past presidential election cycle, the richest man on the planet spent at least $300 million to help get his candidate into the White House and then secure for himself, Elon Musk, that is, a sort of co-presidency for a period, slashing and crashing key agencies that had been funded by Congress. So that Citizens United decision really was a departure from the longstanding understanding that, of course, Congress could regulate corruption and try to prevent corruption in elections. And it supplanted the role of Congress in helping to manage our elections and ensure that we have fair and transparent elections. There are a number of cases where the Roberts Court and John Roberts have really departed from originalism, departed from the plain language of the Constitution, and done so in ways that have really advanced the political agenda of the party that appointed them to the court. One example is where the Roberts Court, pretty quickly after Roberts and Alito were confirmed, took up the so-called partial birth abortion issue, even though the court had previously issued a decision saying that restrictions that had been passed in Nebraska were at odds with the Supreme Court's precedent in Casey. Now, that's an instance where it's not going back to originalism, but it's basically using a change in personnel on the court to revisit a recent past precedent. And then along those same lines, we saw the Roberts Court take up a challenge to the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, which is also known as McCain-Feingold, and related cases and precedent, and strike down the ability of Congress to regulate spending by groups outside of the candidates and the parties. The Supreme Court, again, before this change in personnel, had previously upheld a number of provisions that had allowed Congress to regulate outside money to try to have more transparency and prevent soft money or dark money from really overcoming our electoral process. And so that's another area where there was a departure based on personnel. But also in that instance, the Roberts Court went beyond previous precedents to try to engraft on our First Amendment the idea that money is speech. That's how it's been really simplified or paraphrased. And that Congress lacks the power to regulate that spending by outside groups. Now, that is not the founders' understanding of the First Amendment or elections at all. That was not the framers' understanding of the First Amendment. That's a new interpretation of the First Amendment. They did not rule on that statute on statutory grounds. The Roberts Court tried to locate that specifically in the First Amendment in order to basically give enormous protections for that outside spending and not allow Congress to play the role it has traditionally played in trying to police corruption in our elections, which is the real origin of those federal campaign finance laws. Another area that I think really illustrates, I guess there'll be the third area that I highlight, but another area that really illustrates the departure of this court from prior precedents and from the Constitution and the language itself is the District of Columbia versus Heller case, which is where the Roberts Court, very quickly after Roberts and Alito were confirmed, changed a more than a century of understanding, two centuries of understanding, really, of the meaning of the Second Amendment, transforming it from what was considered to be a collective right into an individual right, and in doing so, threw open the possibility of challenging an array of common sense gun regulations that have been adopted at the federal and state level. Of course, I think I already mentioned the immunity case, which really is the first and foremost and biggest example of the grotesque departure from the language of the Constitution in decisions by John Roberts. And that decision, the immunity case, Trump versus United States, was authored by John Roberts himself.
Lisa, behind all this, you say in your book that in Roberts' rulings, you see his, quote, superseding allegiance, unquote, to the, quote, reactionary political objectives of the Reagan branch of the right-wing movement, and in particular in dismantling the landmark Voting Rights Act in the 2013 decision in Shelby County versus Holder. Tell us about that case and how you believe it exemplifies his superseding allegiance to the Republican Party.
Well, that's right. When I took a hard look at the archival materials, other books from that period, what became quite clear is that John Roberts really was one of a small group of very young Reagan revolutionaries who were trying to move the Reagan administration even further to the right. John Roberts was someone who clerked for Bill Rehnquist, who had a really terrible record on civil rights, quite frankly. He had recommended that the justice he clerked for dissent in Brown versus Board of Education, uphold Plessy versus Ferguson and racial segregation in America. Robert Jackson refused that entreaty by Rehnquist. Rehnquist helped Barry Goldwater back in the 1964 campaign after Goldwater had voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And Rehnquist had also been instrumentally involved in what I think can only fairly be described as voter suppression in Arizona, targeting black voters in the Bethune neighborhood in Phoenix, basically photographing them while they were voting, or at least appearing to photograph them while they were voting in this thing called Operation Eagle Eye. Roberts was clerking for Rehnquist before Reagan won that election. And Rehnquist was someone who had this very hard line. And people who were there on the court at that time, including a fellow clerk, Michael Carvin, wrote about how aligned Roberts was with Bill Rehnquist on civil rights issues, that people noticed this. Now, even though the court in that term did not have any voting rights cases, right before Roberts got there, the court had issued a decision in the Mobile, Alabama case, where the Republicans on that court had sought to cut back Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and say that the effects of a change in voting could not prove a violation of the Voting Rights Act. And Congress, while Rehnquist and Roberts were working together right across the street, Congress was working to undo and overturn that decision. And then what happened was that Rehnquist called Ken Starr, who was the new chief of staff for the new attorney general for Reagan, and urged him to hire John Roberts. Roberts was hired to aid the attorney general as a special assistant at the top of the Justice Department, and he was given a special role in fighting that effort of Congress to overturn that decision, the decision of his mentor about the Voting Rights Act. And John Roberts devoted hundreds of hours to that fight. And even it appears in the historical record that Roberts was pushing to the right of Ronald Reagan and for a period helped hold that line. But ultimately, Reagan, in essence, gave in and Roberts was not successful. But in that instance, Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, other provisions as well, Section 4 and Section 5, for 25 years. And then it just so happened that here we have John Roberts confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2005. Congress was already in the process of reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act for another 25 years. They reauthorized it early in 2006, saying that there was still ample reason for these voting rights provisions, thousands of pages of records. And then what you see happen is that John Roberts basically picks up the fight he lost back in 1981-82, and he uses the court in the Shelby County case to strike a devastating blow against the Voting Rights Act. He does so by suggesting that in his observation, times have changed, that we no longer needed the preclearance provisions that had been core to the Voting Rights Act that basically prevented these states like Alabama and counties like Shelby County that had a history of trying to make it harder for black Americans to vote, of trying to dilute the vote, of voter suppression, that those counties would no longer have to get preclearance from the Justice Department in order to change the rules for voting. So John Roberts was basically laying in wait. And what he did was something that was very unjudicial, in my view, because the job of the Supreme Court, as many people know, but not everyone knows, is to look at the law and is the law being fairly applied. It is not a fact-finding body. It does not have the powers of Congress to hold multiple hearings in the nation's capital and in the states, as happened with the Voting Rights Act, to justify that law. It doesn't have the ability to hold hearings with and cross-examine witnesses the way lower courts do. But in this case, John Roberts set aside thousands of pages of factual findings justifying the Voting Rights Act to assert that basically the time was up, that in his view, even though Congress just a few years earlier had voted almost unanimously to extend the Voting Rights Act, not for 5 years or 10 years, but for another 25 years, and that measure had been signed into law by George W. Bush, with almost all the Republicans joining the Democrats and voting for it, except for a very small contingent of predominantly Southern Republican right-wing legislators who said out loud that they didn't need a majority in Congress to assail the Voting Rights Act, to take this on. They just needed a majority on the court. And with Roberts, they got that majority. Now, the effect of that Shelby County decision was devastating. And within minutes of that ruling, states across the country that had been subject to preclearance, like Texas, for example, announced that they were moving forward with voter ID restrictions and other restrictions on the right to vote. So John Roberts orchestrated this decision in Shelby County, this decision that was really disrespectful of the findings of Congress, really disrespectful of the blood and sweat and tears that won those provisions in the Voting Rights Act. And because of that decision, he has unleashed this more than a decade of actions by state and local governments that have worked to make it harder for Americans to vote, and in particular to make it harder for Black Americans to vote.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Stephen Rohde, co-host along with Heidi Boghossian. Today we're talking with Lisa Graves, author of a new book about Chief Justice John Roberts.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archives and more information about the guests. There you can also make your pledge of support. Lisa, you write that, quote, no Supreme Court majority in American history has ever been constructed the way the Roberts Court has, with the help of big, dark, secret money. Tell us why you reached that conclusion, and please tell our listeners about Leonard Leo and his influence on the court.
Yes, this is an area that I think it's received some coverage, but I don't think people really understand how extraordinary it is to have had a Supreme Court built through the influence of outside money in order to reverse legal precedents. There certainly has been money spent in the latter half of the 20th century around nominations battles, but not to get people on the court to not follow the law, to reverse precedents. And that's what's happened with the Roberts Court. The Roberts Court is very much a court constituted as part of the No More Suitors campaign that really grew out of an effort within the Federalist Society. That effort tried to combat the appointment to the Supreme Court of anyone like David Souter, not because he was a bad judge. He was a fair judge. He followed legal precedents. He did not use that judicial post to reverse the law. And in order to make the kinds of dramatic, I think really radical changes that some in this right-wing movement wanted, they needed to push this movement forward not through the popular will, but through the judiciary and through the capture of the Supreme Court. And Leonard Leo, who was for a long time the vice president of the Federalist Society and now is the co-chair of the Federalist Society, was central to that effort. He really helped gather up the money to secure the appointments of the George W. Bush appointees, to help direct the activities of the outside groups on the pressure campaigns to get Roberts on the bench in the first place, and then confirmed the Supreme Court, along with Sam Alito, confirmed the Supreme Court. And then he was obviously tapped, as almost everyone knows, by Donald Trump to choose the list for the Supreme Court during Donald Trump's first term. And so Leonard Leo handpicked the people on that list. Those individuals were chosen, in my view, not with a view to whether they would be fair and follow legal precedents, but again, with the view of would they be like David Souter, or would they be reliable votes? And we know from some of the reporting around the Roberts nomination and some of the nominations around Amy Coney Barrett and the others, that there was an exaltation, in essence, that these candidates would follow, in essence, the party line, that they would be sure votes on the things that mattered to those big funders and the big constituencies of that right-wing legal movement, on issues of abortion, on trying to limit the power of the federal government in other ways, that these pieces were very significant, almost like a litmus test for these judges, even though they weren't asked them out loud. There's no indication that Leo personally asked them how they would rule. He didn't have to. They were chosen because they were part of that movement and because they were believed to be ready votes to reverse the major precedents of the 20th century and some in the 21st century, and we're seeing that happen before our very eyes.
Lisa, you accuse Roberts of presiding over the most corrupt Supreme Court in American history. So you've talked about how money gets people on the court, and now once they're on the court, tell us what your research has revealed about Justice Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. I wryly add, be sure to tell us all the things the Chief Justice has done about this.
Yes. So that effort to really pack the court, to capture the court, the Washington Post tallied that between 2014 and 2017, that was a $250 million effort to capture the court and also work to change policies, legal policy in America. We updated that figure as of 2021, and that was another total of $600 million that we could trace at that time. It's really more than that, but that's the core amount of money. Well, what does that mean? It means that a number of groups have run multi-million dollar campaigns, if you accumulate the spending, in order to push people onto the court who were very controversial in many quarters in the American population. But not just that. Once these judges have gone onto the court, then we've seen this, what Senator Whitehouse calls the flotilla of amicus briefs coming in to signal to these judges which cases matter, which issues to take up. And then we've also seen, in some instances, a wraparound of trips and gifts. So, for example, one of the things that happened right after Neil Gorsuch was confirmed and then Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed was that the George Mason University Law School, that was then had been renamed the Antonin Scalia Law School, arranged for fabulous summer teaching gigs for Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh abroad. I don't think any justice needs to have any outside group do so. In that instance, the Antonin Scalia Law School was the beneficiary of $20 million that was traced to Barry Side, a Chicago industrialist, and $10 million from Charles Koch to rename the law school, and the internal documents put Leo in charge of some key decisions at that law school. And then that's the law school that arranges these fabulous trips. But what we've seen, and you look at the broader picture, is that this is not new. In essence, you have early reporting a couple decades ago that Clarence Thomas began receiving gifts from a billionaire named Harlan Crow. That accelerated over time. There was reporting recently about how in the late 90s, Clarence Thomas was, in essence, threatening to leave the bench if he wasn't paid more, if he didn't have more compensation to live in the lifestyle that he wanted to. And since then, there's been a flow of gifts that has been tallied now to have a value of more than $4 million over the past 2+ decades. Not all from Harlan Crow, but a number of those trips, big trips, foreign trips on luxury yachts, frequent trips on private jets, vacations, and more have been given to Clarence Thomas by Harlan Crow, who befriended him after he got on the D.C. Circuit. More than that, we've also seen Clarence Thomas receive gifts of six-figure luxury RV that he never paid back, the loan for that. There's other gifts that we've also seen in terms of gifts of tuition for his wards, gifts of letting his mother stay in a home that Harlan Crow was renovating. And so that's just the Clarence Thomas part of the story, in addition to going off to fabulous trips at the Bohemian Grove, or being treated to trips to talk to the donors in the Charles Koch donor network. So that is a huge set of scandals. But not only that, we've also seen Sam Alito has taken gifts, including gifts of travel by billionaires who have a political agenda for the country and for the court, as well as people like Paul Singer who had litigation that ultimately ended up before the Supreme Court. We also have seen reporting that Antonin Scalia was a frequent participant in a series of gifts of travel for his hunting trips and the recipient of other gifts. And so it's really reached a head due to the reporting uncovering this a few years ago. And John Roberts has done basically nothing to redress the scandals that have engulfed the court. And I say that because, in fact, he's done worse than nothing. John Roberts has tried to deter Congress from passing legislation. He's, in essence, suggested that Congress doesn't have the power to pass ethics legislation. He's refused to come before the Senate to respond to questions in public about these trips, these gifts that Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito have accepted and not recused on. He has done nothing about the fact that Clarence Thomas participated in the Citizens United decision, even though his wife had just received a gift of $500,000 to fund her organization that was being created to take advantage of the Citizens United decision before it was issued. John Roberts, instead, as the United States Senate was poised to vote on subpoenas to Harlan Crow and Leonard Leo, instead, John Roberts issued a public statement in which he said that there is an ethics code for the court, for the Supreme Court, and that each justice asserts and says signed that he or she follows that code. Now, that code is not enforceable. There's no external mechanism for enforcing any provision. And these justices have not recused themselves, even in cases like Clarence Thomas's wife, Jenny Thomas, actively urging Mark Meadows to stop the implementation of the 2020 election. Clarence Thomas continued to sit on cases around January 6th and the insurrection, continued to sit on cases around Trump's assertion of immunity, even though his wife had been actively engaged in trying to prevent that election from being counted. John Roberts did nothing about that. And in fact, when you look at the non-enforceable code that he announced on the eve of that Senate committee vote, what you see is that that code is weaker than the mandatory code that applies to lower court judges, the code of conduct for U.S. judges. And in fact, that code even asserts, it's shocking to me, that code even asserts that a justice can sit on a case even if he or she has a conflict of interest if their vote is needed to resolve the case. That is not federal law. That's not the law that applies to other judges. But that's the kind of situation that John Roberts has tolerated and, in fact, embraced.
Lisa, as we look to the future, your book suggests a few ideas for reform. Can you talk about those?
Yes, I'm very excited to talk about those because we have opportunities to change this. It doesn't have to be this way. And in fact, when you look at what this court is doing, how active this court is in destroying and limiting core freedoms, really revisiting core wins of the 20th century, I think it becomes not just an idea, but a necessity. And so in my book, I talk about how there are a number of really important proposals for reform and that we actually have to work for reform, even though nothing good could pass right now. We have to build the movement for reform. And that includes a number of provisions like the No Kings Act, to make it clear that presidents aren't immune from criminal prosecution. It includes the John Lewis Voting Rights Restoration Act to restore the power of the federal government to prevent efforts to suppress the vote. I think we also need to take on the idea of expanding the court. The court is 9 members only by historical accident, in essence. It's not mandated by the Constitution. And the court has much more business that it could hear if it had more justices on the court, but of course, only if those justices were chosen fairly and to be fair judges. There are also proposals to embrace term limits that would limit how long someone could serve on the bench, that would have the effect of limiting the effort to put people on the court who are really young ideologues rather than have people who are more experienced, perhaps have better and longer reputations for fairness. There are also proposals to bar gifts to federal judges, to have gift restrictions with teeth, not just disclosure, which has also been, I think, avoided by some on the court, like Justice Thomas. There could also be reforms on a whole host of other issues to overturn rulings of this court that have really stretched the bounds of the Constitution, like overcoming the Heller decision and the Brewer decisions on gun policy. That's just a few of the things that I think we should be thinking about. that ranges from substantive policy matters to ethics issues. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention how important it would be to include not just the gift ban, but real serious disclosure about who's paying for these amicus briefs, as Senator Whitehouse has put forward in the Amicus Act. There are just so many things where, when you look at them more closely, this court, it has been acting in a way that is inconsistent, I think, with the high ethical standards that the many other courts, that most other courts in this country operate under. And we have to reform that. And in the process, we also have to reform the substantive problems that have been introduced into our political system by these rulings that have unmoored our American democracy. That's why I began with talking about the No Kings Act, because that ruling in Trump versus United States did unmoor the United States from one of the key principles of our democracy, which is that presidents are not above the law and cannot be above the law.
Lisa, your book concludes that, quote, John Roberts has presided over a Supreme Court that routinely limits the rights of ordinary people while elevating the rights of corporations and the powerful. Your book essentially went to print before the new era of the second term of Donald Trump, the last 10 months where the Supreme Court has played a pivotal role, largely in empowering and enabling Donald Trump. So how do you see these last 10 months, and are they consistent with the premise of your book itself?
It really is extraordinary. You know, I was very concerned last year when the Supreme Court decided to take up the Trump versus United States case and not simply allow the lower court ruling by the D.C. Circuit that Trump did not have the kind of expansive immunity that he was asserting. I was really concerned that the court would do what it did, which was create out of whole cloth this expansive idea that a president is above the law as long as he's engaged in his so-called official acts. I'm sorry to say that I was accurate in predicting, in essence, that this court, in taking up that case, was not going to affirm the longstanding precedents. And so I do believe, and as I wrote in my book, which, you know, is, I had to finish right as the Trump administration was coming into power, I do believe that whatever extremes Trump pursues in 2025 and beyond, that those sins must fall at Roberts' feet, because John Roberts exonerated Trump, in essence, retrospectively, said that he could not have committed a crime or crimes in the past as president, if anything was asserted to be an official act, and gave him immunity prospectively. And in sending those signals to the American people, certainly signaled to some people that Trump could do no wrong and did no wrong. And that helped pave the way for Trump's return to power. I'm telling you that I was right about that, but I was still, I did not fully anticipate how terribly destructive this initial decision, the immunity decision, would be in the sense of what came next. I was concerned about what was going to happen this past year, that Trump had suggested in a number of ways he himself was above the law. Then he had, in essence, the ratification of that idea by this court. What would he do with that kind of power? And what we've seen is an extraordinary series of edicts by this president challenging the idea, the language of the 14th Amendment, that a person who's born in the United States is a citizen. We've seen the challenge by this administration of due process, that the due process in the Constitution applies to persons, not just citizens, that people have a right to due process before their life or their liberty is taken by the state, by the government. A whole series of actions by this administration to ignore congressional statutes on budgets and spending, rules related to federal employees, the civil servants who work for us. What we see from the past 10 months is that this Roberts court, Roberts and his cohorts, have set aside 24 temporary restraining orders by lower court judges. These were and are well-reasoned rulings by lower court appointees, appointed by judges ranging from, you know, Reagan, the first Bush, Clinton, the second Bush, Obama, and even Trump himself, Yet this court has decided that those rulings that put a temporary halt to some of Donald Trump's most extreme initiatives, his most extreme edicts, that they can go forward while the lower court cases are pending. That really flips on its head the way a temporary restraining order is supposed to work and has acted throughout our history of this procedure. Under this procedure, if the party seeking relief, the party who says this new action is harming my rights or violating the law, if that party shows that they have a substantial likelihood of success under existing case law or statute or constitution, regulation, or contract, and they also show that there's a significant chance that they're going to suffer irreparable harm, not just harm, but irreparable harm if this policy goes forward until the matter is fully adjudicated on the merits, then a temporary restraining order is warranted. And in these instances, in more than 24 judges, but in 24 sets of litigation, what you have is lower court judges sometimes having witnesses come in and having them be cross-examined or relying on the attestations, of fact, people under oath talking about what's happening, looking thoroughly at the case law, at the precedents. These lower court judges and the intermediate appellate courts, for the most part, have found that a number of these extreme provisions relating activities relating to immigration, including seizing people and stopping them on the street, which are now being called Kavanaugh stops, that these things are in violation of existing and, in fact, long-standing law. But this Roberts court has acted as though the irreparable harm is only to the president if he cannot do as he wishes. And so I didn't really see these two bookends happening in that way. I was fearful that when that immunity decision came down, if Trump were reelected, the court would find it difficult to stop him, even if it had the will to do so. But what I didn't anticipate was how aggressively the Roberts court would act toward any significant decisions by lower court judges to constrain Trump, even when he's not asserting that he himself is immune from criminal prosecution. Instead, when he's asserting that he, as president, has the power to disregard congressional budgets and just take money from one program and direct it to another, or cancel contracts that were already approved or that were approved and funded by Congress in laws passed on a bipartisan basis and signed into law by the prior president, I did not anticipate that this court would act as such an enabler of Trump's extremism, even with how counter-constitutional that immunity ruling was. I am in shock, quite frankly, at how quickly the Roberts court has devolved into almost an appendage of Trump in battling the lower court judges who have been doing their job under the law, under the rules, under longstanding procedures. And yet this court has sought to intervene to stop those lower court rulings. Now, the easiest thing for the Roberts court to have done in the face of those rulings was to just let them stand until the lower court reaches the decisions on the merits and then take up those cases in the ordinary course of an appeal and rule on them on the merits. But it has not. In fact, it has acted in ways that have created a lot of concern, as we've seen reported in the press, by a number of federal judges, and that has also had the effect of having the American people lose even further respect for the court as a place where there's any perception that it can be trusted, really, to protect our rights. The court is at the lowest point in all the polling over the last, several years, decades, consistent with the polling from 2023, 2024, 2025. This court is not held in high regard by the American people anymore. One of the things that really gives me hope is the dissenting opinions by Justices Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. These dissents are historic dissents, and they're in some ways really courageous dissents from these emergency rulings, these shadow docket rulings, where The Roberts Court has cleared the way for Trump to take actions that no other president has dared to take, that no other president has in some ways ever been presumed to have the power to take. And so I really would encourage your listeners and people everywhere to read the dissenting opinions in these cases, including in the immunity case as well, because they very powerfully set forth core principles of American democracy, of our freedoms, of our history, and they reveal how, unfortunately, the Roberts Court is engaging in such a really political and partisan way, unmoored from our core precedents and even key principles like checks and balances that are core to our Constitution. And so I think that in the great expanse of history, ultimately, their dissents will be vindicated. Hopefully their dissents will become the rule of law someday when we look back on this period as an unfortunate chapter in American history where the court under John Roberts lost its way, and where America for a period in essence lost its way before we return to, you know, the arc of progress and moving forward in having a thriving democracy, not one that is marked by the kind of repression and extremism that we've seen come from this administration and that we've seen validated, at least through these temporary restraining orders that have been overturned by this Roberts Court. I look forward to the day when the Voting Rights Act is restored, when people have more power in our democracy than the billionaires, and when we have a court that is filled with judges who are fair and devoted to following the law, rather than people who are trying to drive the law back to the robber baron era of the 19th and early 20th century.
Lisa, how can people learn more about court accountability, your organization, and True North Research?
Yes, we have websites, courtaccountability.org and truenorthresearch.org. We'll have ways for people to participate in efforts to help reform the court on those sites, and also the book site withoutprecedent.info. And we also have regular conversations on Legal AF about reform, including leaders of the reform movement.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us again today on Law and Disorder, and thank you for all the work you're doing every single day to preserve democracy and the rule of law.
Stephen and Heidi, it's been a joy to be on with you. I'm so grateful for your time and your devotion to law and to justice.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with historian Paul LeBlanc on the tremendous socialist victory of Zoran Mandani in the race for mayor in New York City on November 4th.
Does the Mandani victory in New York portend a rollback of the authoritarian and fascist forces now governing America? We also look at the critical response and the lawsuit passed against the recent education code change in California, allowing teachers to be monitored and disciplined in regards to what they teach about Israel and Palestine. We talk with returning guest Professor Emeritus Marjorie Cohn about AB 715 and her recent article addressing the lawsuit brought against state leaders on behalf of California public school teachers and parents of students.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
34-year-old Zoran Mamdani an immigrant from Uganda, a Muslim, and a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, won in an overwhelming victory in New York City's primary in September, and then won the mayoral race in New York City on November 4th. His team of some 100,000 door knockers, canvassers, and phone bankers swept the charismatic Mondani into first place over the former governor and mainline Democrat Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo was supported financially and politically by 28 different billionaires, Wall Street, and the real estate interests. The tops of the Democratic Party refused to endorse Zohran even after Mamdani won the Democratic primary, and then even after he won the mayoral race. Trump smeared Zohran as a, quote, lunatic communist, and has already cut off $18 billion of federal funding for the state of New York. The victory of Mamdani and the magnificent movement behind him came after the No Kings demonstrations attended by millions across the country. It is the most significant development so far in the fight back against the oligarchs, authoritarians, and fascist forces in the USA. The Mamdani success has changed the relationship of forces between the American people and their rulers like nothing we have ever seen since the huge rebellion against the Vietnam War in 1968. What are the implications for New York City and beyond, for the growth and influence of socialist ideas, and for the DSA? We speak today with returning guest historian Paul LeBlanc, professor emeritus of history at La Roche University in Pittsburgh, and an active member of the Pittsburgh chapter of the DSA. He's the author of many books on socialism and labor history, and most recently a contributor to A User's Guide to the DSA, with an article entitled An Effective Force for Socialism. Professor Paul LeBlanc, welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thanks, Michael. It's really good to be back.
Well, it's really good to have you, Paul. Paul, you've been an active leftist for six decades. Please give us a sketch of your political development and what you made you a socialist.
Well, let's see. I've got 27 minutes before this show is over, so this is going to take a while. So let me do a succinct summary. One thing is that my parents and other members of my family were part of the trade union movement and were labor and left-wing activists, and that influenced me profoundly. And then, of course, as I was starting to go through my teenage years, there was the Cuban Revolution, there was the Civil Rights Movement, there was the Vietnam War that were all unfolding. And so that influenced me, and I was able to be involved in the anti-war movement and a little bit the civil rights movement, and that influenced me very much. And I considered myself part of the New Left, and I was a member of Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, for a number of years, and then that collapsed. And by the time it collapsed, I was already a socialist, a conscious socialist, and felt that there was a need for something better than what SDS was able to be. And I was drawn to the Socialist Workers' Party and to the Trotskyist tradition, and was, you know, active in that for about 10 years. That organization unfortunately went bad, and then I was involved in various fragments in the wake of that development, including especially Solidarity. I then became part of the International Socialist Organization, which for a time had a couple thousand members. Then that collapsed, and so most recently I've been involved in a fragment of that group called Tempest, the Tempest Collective. I've also rejoined Solidarity because I'm in basic agreement with that. But then most recently I joined and became active in Democratic Socialists of America. So those are the three groups that I'm part of now. I see this whole development as a process. We need a revolutionary socialist organization that has a mass base that doesn't exist yet, but it seems to me some of the elements that could constitute such an organization and such a movement are in the process of evolving, and I'd like to be part of that and help out with that as best I can.
Mm-hmm. What was it, though, that drew you now more recently into the Democratic Socialists of America, Paul?
Well, as I said a moment ago, I see DSA as part of that process, and it is certainly the biggest of the organizations. It's very diverse, very open, with a lot of relatively young activists in it. It's alive. It's contradictory, but it's an important element, it seems to me, in the political chemistry can result in a mass socialist movement. So I want to be part of that. I want to connect with the younger comrades who are doing that or trying to do that kind of thing.
Paul, tell us about the DSA. What does it stand for? Are there various factions inside of the DSA? What are their members doing? What's their size? What percentage of the membership is active? And what percentage is on paper only? Can you give us a feeling for this? And is it growing?
Yes. Those are excellent questions. DSA is a very sort of elaborate.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.